Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me to this really nice conference. I appreciate how broad this conference is. We have a lot of people here, some more theory-oriented, some experimentalists, people who emphasize the machine learning, people who emphasize quantum information. It's all it's very stimulating. So I work at a place called X, the Moonshot Factory. We are a Alphabet company alongside Google. And what we do is we work on crazy things. That's our job. And one such crazy thing is quantum computing. I should say that I have some Google collaborators on this, people from the Google Accelerated Science team who did all of the hard parts of this work, which is still work mostly finished, but still a little bit in progress. I guess I'll say that I'll mention machine learning toward the end. Most of the machine learning part was done by these people. And you can ask me questions about the machine learning part, but I'll probably not know the answers. And in fact, most of what this turns out to be is a challenge for people who are interested in applying machine learning to the things I'm going to be talking about. All right, so the topic of this talk is something that's come up a couple of times already in this conference, which is quantum computing. So this is a really nice plot about the state of quantum computing, both now and into the future. So this comes from the U.S. National Academy of Sciences' recent report on quantum computing, which is a really nice document to read. And the idea here is that it's illustrating the sort of, how many qubits you have versus how good your qubits are in terms of what sorts of things you're able to do with them. So the key things here are these curves, which indicate the thresholds for being able to reach quantum error correction, where you can do logical operations on qubits without having to worry about errors. And if you want to do things like factor large numbers or run Grover's algorithm, things like that, you have to be up here. And here we are today, roughly speaking. We're down, we have only a few qubits, and they're all relatively noisy. And we'll be working our way in this direction over time, hopefully. But down here today, and probably for the near future, 5 years, 10 years, I don't know, we'll be in what's called the NISQ regime. I don't know that this term has come up before, but in this conference, but NISQ, NISQ, noisy intermediate scale quantum, refers to the kind of quantum computers that we have available now, the kind that will probably be what we're stuck with for a little while. And there's a question of what can you do with them? A lot of people have ideas about what to do with them, but part of the magic, I guess, of the NISQ era is that the quantum computers are getting to the size where you can't really simulate classically exactly what they're going to do, right? On your laptop, you might be able to simulate 15, 20 qubits, something like that. If you have access to more powerful computing resources, you can get 30, 40. But beyond 50 or so qubits, it's very difficult to tell exactly what's going to pop out of the quantum computer at the end of the day. And making this even more difficult, there's the issue of noise, which in a real quantum computer would be very complicated. The noise model is, a very complicated thing. And so we don't really know what things the quantum computer will really be capable of, and especially what useful things it'll be capable of. So something which was also emphasized in this National Academy of Science report, which I think deserves to be more emphasized, is that the goal of people working in quantum computing is to someday have these large error-corrected quantum computers, fault-tolerant quantum computers. But it costs a lot of money to build one, right, and to develop one. And you know, that money has to come from somewhere. And when it came to the development of classical computers, every time a new classical computer was built that was better than the previous one, it could be used to, you know, make more money. And there's sort of an economic engine driving the development of, driving Moore's law of development of classical computers. And it would be really nice if there was a similar thing for quantum computers. And I say this not just because I work for a corporation, but because, you know, it's good, you know, for the world of quantum computing. You know, we don't, without such a thing, the development would slow to a crawl and be funded mostly by governments or a few larger corporations. And I'm sure, as all of you know, right now there are lots of startups in the quantum computing space, and it would be really nice if there were things for all of them to do. So this talk is about, you know, what kinds of things, or a certain kind of thing that you might want to try to do, that people are trying to do with near-term quantum computers. And, well, I'm not going to be able to answer the question of here's an application, but I'll talk about some of the things that people are looking at, or one of the things people are looking at in the sort of sphere of near-term applications. So just a reminder of what it means to use a quantum computer. So this is something that everybody knows, but we need to keep in mind, keep at the front of our minds all the time. So the output, when you run a quantum computer, you run a quantum circuit, a digital quantum computer, and you get some kind of output. What is that output? Well, what happens is you run a quantum circuit, you measure, and you get a bit string at the end, a string of zeros and ones. So, I mean, in theory land, we often like to talk about things like expectation values and correlation functions, blah, blah, blah. But those are all derived quantities that you get after sampling many times. Really, all you get every time you run the quantum computer is a bit string, okay? And you're gonna want to, if you wanna compute something like an expectation value, you're gonna need to sample a lot of bit strings, okay? You're gonna try your best to arrange the Born distribution, right? Design your quantum circuit so that these bit strings are useful in some way, okay? That's the goal of quantum computing. And you're gonna wanna limit the number of calls that you make to the quantum computer, okay? Because the idea here, the axiom, is that calls to the quantum computer are going to be expensive, either because they take a while, or, you know, the quantum computer is a scarce resource. There aren't gonna be, you know, a lot of people are gonna wanna use it, and so you're not gonna have a lot of time. You wanna make your algorithms as efficient as possible to limit the number of times you actually call the quantum computer. So we already had a couple of talks yesterday about the QAOA, and that's gonna be the topic of this talk as well. So optimization with the QAOA. So my use of the QAOA is gonna be slightly different from what we saw yesterday. For me, as in the original paper, the QAOA is gonna be about solving some kind of combinatorial optimization problem, some classical problem, not finding the ground state of some quantum Hamiltonian, but rather finding a low energy state of a computational basis Hamiltonian, okay, which is really just, you know, we wanna find a bit string which minimizes some, or which has a relatively low cost with respect to some cost function. And we can talk about that cost function as if it were an energy or a Hamiltonian, that's fine. But there are two things to keep in mind. One is I don't actually care about getting the lowest energy state or the optimal bit string, okay? All I want is one that's relatively low energy. That's the first A, the approximate in QAOA. The other thing to keep in mind is that, of course, the recipe, the QAOA recipe works for any kind of cost function, but more complicated ones will be harder to simulate or, you know, be more difficult to actually get it to work, okay? And the circuit is variational, okay? There are some parameters that need to be tuned. We saw these parameters yesterday, and figuring out what those optimal parameters are is an important aspect of this problem. That's not what I'm gonna be talking about, but that's an important aspect of this problem. Finally, the thing that people always say is that the QAOA is based on the adiabatic theorem or the adiabatic algorithm, but is different in practice. In fact, for me, it's going to be very different. We heard yesterday how in one of yesterday's talks, we heard that, in fact, the adiabatic algorithm is very different from what the QAOA is doing. And actually, if you ask Eddie Farhi, he will tell you that, I don't know if I believe him, he will tell you that the adiabatic algorithm was not really in his mind when the QAOA was thought up, although I find that a bit suspicious. So here is the formula for the QAOA, which we saw yesterday. So there's these two P parameters, gammas and conventionally called gammas and betas. Okay. You start with so E is going to be our Hamiltonian or our cost function. I use E instead of H because H in quantum computing always stands for Hadamard. This is the thing that H acting on zeros prepares the superposition over all bit strings. And then which is the eigenstate of X, which is an eigenstate of X on all qubits. And then we act with this sequence of operations, alternating sequence of operations, to try and get this state psi to be a low energy state. Of course, that's not even really true, okay? That's true if your objective is to actually find the ground state of something, of some Hamiltonian, especially some quantum Hamiltonian. But remember, that's not my objective. My objective is to try and find a low energy bit string, okay? And the way that we find low energy bit strings is by preparing this state and then sampling, okay? And really, every time I sample, I get a bit string, and then I can go classically compute the cost function on that one bit string, okay? And the output of the algorithm, the ultimate output of the algorithm, is just gonna be one of these bit strings, the one I find that has the lowest energy. So actually, I don't care if this psi state itself has low energy. What I care about is that it has a large amplitude in low energy states, so that I have a large probability of getting a low energy state when I sample. So just as an example, a state that I would be perfectly happy with, okay, incredibly happy with, is one that was an equal superposition of the ground state and the highest energy state, okay? That state would have, that state, the expectation value of the energy in that state would be somewhere in the middle, but it would have a very high probability of giving me the best bit string, and that's all I really care about. Okay, that's just an important thing to remember. Again, here is a picture that we often draw. So if this is sort of an adiabatic algorithm type path through parameter space, the QAOA is often depicted as some kind of discretized version of this path. But of course, this picture may be quite misleading. And in fact, for this talk, this picture won't be useful at all. Why? Because I'm going to focus on the case P equals one, all right? So we're only gonna do these first couple of operations here and then drop the rest and see what happens. All right, so here's the P equals one circuit. This is all we're gonna do. In this case, three qubits, but I'll allow myself to use more than three qubits, but this is gonna be the circuit, and we're gonna try and find one of these low energy bit strings. All right, so for the first part of this talk, I'm gonna review a little bit more in detail about what the QAOA is doing. There'll be some formulas to try and build some intuition about how this kind of P equals one QAOA can help us solve these kinds of problems. Okay, so first, the QAOA according to Schrodinger. Okay, this is the way that we were talking about it so far. We apply these operations, we get some state. Okay, and hopefully the state at the end has some large amplitude to be in a good bit string. We begin by getting the superposition over all bit strings, okay? If we stopped now, we would be in trouble, because now if you measure here, all you'll find is any bit string with a uniform distribution over all bit strings, not very helpful, just like random guessing. Next, we add some phases by applying our cost function. Once again, if we stopped now, we would get a uniform distribution on all bit strings because all we did was add some phases, but the Born probabilities only depend on the squares of these coefficients, so the phases don't matter at this point. Only when we finally act with our X operation do we get something interesting. Now you can get interference. Now it becomes sort of difficult to, now it starts to become difficult to compute what's happening. But you can do some kind of, you know, use this as a variational ansatz to try and figure out what the, you know, what good parameters are such that the interference pattern is good, okay? Now let's talk about the QAOA according to Feynman. So I have this in here because I think it provides some useful intuition. It's not something people often talk about. And one of my takeaway messages from spending a few years at Caltech is that you should always talk about Feynman. So here it is. So QAOA according to Feynman means think about what I would call the QAOA propagator, okay? So Feynman loved propagators. So if you can compute this propagator actually fairly easily, and what you find is you find, well, some phase and some normalization that doesn't depend on the states, and then something that depends on the Hamming distance between the states, between the bit strings. So the Hamming distance is just the number of places where the two bit strings differ, okay? And if you sort of look at this thing here and try to, and you imagine, you know, writing it as E to something, it looks like a tunneling type factor. If you try to think of this as a conventional propagator, there's a phase part, and then there's a real part to the exponential, which you can think of in terms of tunneling. So this I think is part of what people mean when they say that, you know, in the energy landscape, these kinds of quantum algorithms allow tunneling between different locations. So it comes from something like this. And we can use this to help us do an example calculation. So just as a sort of toy model to see how the QAOA at p equals 1 might work, imagine a toy problem where I just pick some bit string z0 to be the ground state. And imagine that away from z0, every bit flip you make away from z0 costs some amount of energy epsilon. And then let's use this propagator to compute the amplitude of being in the state z0. At the end of the algorithm. And you can do this. It's not a difficult calculation. And it turns out that the probability of being in z0 depending on these two parameters, beta and gamma. And now we see that, indeed, if we choose beta and gamma such that this factor here is equal to -1, then this probability is equal to 1. And with those values of the parameters, the probability of being in the ground state at the end is 1, and so actually the p equals 1 QAOA could exactly solve this problem for us. Note, the another interesting thing to note here is that even though I found an analytical formula in terms of beta and gamma for this probability, and therefore, you know, can figure out without doing any variational algorithm at all what the optimal parameters are, I still don't know what z0 is. I just said there is some z0 which has these properties. And so what I would still do is I would take these parameters, construct my quantum circuit, give it to the quantum computer, sample from the quantum computer to extract what the bit string actually was. This kind of thing is actually the best case scenario for the QAOA because we only really need to use the quantum computer once. And one of the goals, right, should be to minimize the use of the quantum computer, as I already said. So being able to analytically figure out what some of these optimal parameters are is a good thing. All right, so now let's move on. The QAOA according to Heisenberg. So this is a useful point of view on the QAOA when you have sort of a cost function, which is a sum of terms like this, because it lets you treat each of these terms kind of individually. So here's an example. So if we have some kind of Ising model on a graph where there are couplings associated to the edges of the graph, so here is a 3x3 square lattice, and we can imagine choosing these couplings in some random way so that the problem is not easily solved analytically. In some of the numerics I'll show later, the couplings, we happen to choose the couplings uniformly between -1 and 1, but those details don't matter so much. And you can try and use the QA way to solve a problem like this. And a useful way to analyze this sort of problem is by the sort of Heisenberg method. And the reason being that as was mentioned yesterday, and as I'll say later, the usual way people talk about the QAOA is in terms of optimizing, the way you tune the parameters is by optimizing the expectation value of this operator. Although, it's not clear that that's really what you want to do. So, the Hamiltonian, okay, looks like this, or the gamma time evolution operator looks like this, which you can write out as a product of these things, and this kind of exponential of z times z on two neighboring qubits, or two qubits that are joined together, is pretty easy to realize in terms of more conventional gates that people talk about in quantum computing, z rotations and controlled z rotations and things like that. That's the point of this equation. It's not terribly important for us today. And as I already said, if you try to tune the parameters by minimizing this expectation value of the energy, then the Heisenberg point of view is often a good point of view. The reason is that you can take the time evolution operators and use them to evolve E rather than construct psi. And if you do that, the Heisenberg evolution for Zi times Zj, which is one of the ingredients of E, for p equals 1, only involves the nearest neighbors of the I and j qubits, which is nice if you have, for example, a square lattice. It would look like this, which is not, it's a very local kind of thing. And so now I've got a few slides with some equations. The equations don't matter so much. I put them up here because I'm one of these people who likes doing algebra, and I want to convince you that I know how to do algebra. So. Although I do have like a random B here for some reason. So you go through this exercise. And you go through this exercise some more. And here's the answer. So this is for a square lattice, you can find the expectation value of the energy in terms of beta and gamma, and these couplings J. And here's a plot of what it looks like for some random instance of the couplings J. It looks like this. Notice that beta pops out in front only as a normalization. So if you want to maximize or minimize the expectation value of E, it's just clear what to choose for beta. So that saves you one variational parameter. And then you can numerically just plug in what this formula is. Here it is. And the optimal value of gamma is right there. You can numerically even just solve for gamma and then plug into the quantum computer and run it and sample several times to get some low energy bit strings. Okay, so this is another example, which is kind of a best case scenario where you can figure out the beta and the gamma ahead of time. Of course, part of the reason why I'm able to figure out these betas and gammas ahead of time is because I'm doing the p equals 1 version, right? It becomes much more complicated if we go away from p equals 1. But okay, for now, and in perhaps even in real life, if your problem is complicated enough, the number of connections between qubits is high enough, then perhaps p equals 1 is all you have when you account for errors in your gate. Question?
I might be blind, but if sine theta is 0, gamma should be
independent of gamma. Yeah. So if sine beta is 0, then the expectation value is independent of gamma. Yeah, and so for example, if beta equals 0, then sine beta would be 0. And in that case, it's clear that the expectation value should be independent of gamma because the circuit just becomes trivial because because now you're not even doing the x operation anymore. And then this formula basically tells you that behavior is periodic in beta with a certain period. But here's the general formula for the square lattice, at least. All right, so that's the QAOA. And for the rest of my time, I'll talk about how maybe we could possibly do better. And of course, we could do better by increasing P, but besides increasing P, can we do better? Okay. And the motivation here is that the QAOA, I mean, we've already forgotten, the adiabatic motivation is already, long forgotten, right? We're at P equals one. We didn't really, we've already discussed how this thing is different from the adiabatic algorithm anyway. But if that's the case, why are we even doing it? Okay, it's because it's something some human thought up, but humans are limited. Can we do better? Well, okay, first let's come back to this issue that I've alluded to a few times. Why are we even using energy as the variational objective here? Okay, I began with this example of a state where the expectation value of the energy is not very impressive, but it's really good at solving the problem I want to solve, the thing which was bimodal at low energies and high energies. What we really want to maximize is the probability of finding a low energy state, which is more like this, okay? The expectation value of some theta function. And I'm sure someone should go and try this. I'm sure people have. In fact, before we're done with this work, we probably will too, although we haven't actually tried doing this. The reason why I don't particularly like this is that I would expect, based on the E0 that you chose and what state that you get, you might just get zero for some large range of variational parameters if you choose this as your function, and you might have some problem with gradients.
I know lots of theta functions.
Oh, sorry, this is a step function. Yeah. Step function. We're very lowbrow here. So. Okay, but a step function looks kind of like an exponential decay. At least to me it does. So so an exponential decay type profile similarly emphasizes things over here, discounts things over here, and so why don't we try a different kind of objective function? Something that the name that I give it changes all the time, but for now I'm calling it the Gibbs objective function. Why Gibbs? Because it looks kind of like the free energy, which is associated with Gibbs. And so what you do is you take the expectation value of the exponential of the energy, and you have some extra hyperparameter. You can estimate what this hyperparameter is if you know something about the energy scales in the problem you're trying to solve. And you can always tune the hyperparameter as you go. In practice, the kinds of problems, the scenario that we're imagining here is that there's a class of problems that you're interested in, such as the Ising models on a square lattice, but then the couplings are random. That's an ensemble of problems, right? Where the couplings are drawn from some distribution. And for that ensemble of problems, there's going to be some value of eta, which is pretty good on all of those problems, and you just fix it, and then you work on all of those problems with that value of eta. So it's not something you have to tune. It's not like beta and gamma that you have to tune it on each instance. It's an easier thing to tune, and so we're just going to ignore the difficulty of tuning it. I mean, for what we did here, we stared at the problems for the numerics we did, said eta equals 20 or something seems right, and then we just went with it and it worked. And we tried a couple different values and it didn't work as well. So that was, it's just a simple hyperparameter to tune. And this thing helps, it turns out. What else can we do? So now this is the more challenging part. Something other than the ordinary QAOA ansatz. Okay, besides just going to P equals two. In other words, can we extend the search space of our variational algorithm beyond just those circuits that are connected to each other by changing these variational parameters? And a natural thing to do is just add and remove gates, okay, from the circuit, sort of discrete changes of the circuit. I mean, another natural thing to do is to just, introduce another parameter, introduce another continuous parameter. Rather than giving all of the two-qubit gates the same parameter, just give half of them one parameter and half of them another parameter. It increases the complexity of the model. It sort of has to do better than it did before. Then you have another sort of continuous tuning. This is sort of like that. Removing a gate is sort of like that, except it's saying on some of the gates, I'm going to set the parameter equal to zero, and on others, I'll keep it non-zero. So it's somewhere in between those two things. But it increases the complexity of the model a little bit, but not as much as adding another continuous parameter. So the focus here is going to be on removing the two-qubit gates. So what we have in the QAOA, we've got these X rotations, and then we've got these ZZ operations in the problems that I'm considering. And what I'm just going to do is I'm just going to go in and remove from the circuit by hand some of these ZZ rotation gates and just see what happens. Okay. The part of the motivation here was that if you have fewer gates around, then there's fewer opportunities for errors if you have a noisy quantum computer. So, that's why I'm focusing on removing gates rather than adding gates. But you don't want to, this sentence is kind of weird. You removing the gates may help you, if the probability of getting a low energy state remained the same without noise, removing a gate you'd think would help. But you don't want the probability to get worse. And it turns out, actually, the probability of getting a low energy state often gets much better if you remove gates for some reason.
Is your methodology to remove a gate, do your measurement, and then move a different gate?
No. So the methodology that we've explored for now is, just generally speaking, we are going to remove the added complexity that comes from the fact that you, if you wanted to get an expectation value, you'd have to measure many times, right? So we're going to imagine every time I have a circuit, I have two choices. Either I can run the quantum computer with that circuit many times, enough that I can compute reliable expectation values, or I cannot run the quantum computer at all. So if I remove the gate, and then choose to run that circuit on the quantum computer, I'm just going to allow myself to run it many times, get many measurements before I remove another gate. But doing a more refined procedure is what you would want to do in practice probably, but it's a more complicated analysis. And numerically speaking, what that means is we're just going to allow ourselves to compute things by using the wave function. We're not going to simulate sampling. We're going to simulate the whole wave function. But that's a sort of a detail. So here's some examples. Okay. So here's sort of a 4x4 square lattice type Ising model. Here's the other type of model I'll consider in this talk is a sort of a complete graph. In this case, on 10 qubits. And the color codes here are the different couplings. So I think red is close to +1, blue is close to -1, and then the other colors are closer to 0. And so these are just some random instances of the problems that, problem classes you can consider. And here you see this number here says for this particular circuit, which, is missing some of its two-qubit gates, the probability of getting a low energy state is 30% higher than it was for this circuit. Okay. And we have 17 out of the 24 possible, out of the original 24 gates, we only have 17. And here, for example, we only had 26 out of the 45 original gates, and we got 3 times higher probability of getting a low energy state. So these are some examples of what happens when you just start removing gates and seeing what goes on. And so, I should also mention, and this will come up again, that these things were optimized using the Gibbs objective function, although we can. So the noise is, we aren't simulating the noise at all here. So the noise has not entered things. And in fact, If you try and estimate how the noise would affect things using some kind of simple depolarization channel or something as a first approximation, actually the effect of noise is going to be really small compared to like the total, you know, the total change in probability here. So at the end of the day, I think it turns out that the noise, even though it was part of our original goal or original motivation, at least for these small instance sizes, I think the noise actually isn't really an issue at all. More of a motivational thing.
I don't see any pattern, you know, say the red one, you know, the red ones or the blue ones that you're removing.
Yeah.
Is there any intuition that I better?
No. So this is the problem. This is the problem. Which gates do you remove? Okay. Figuring that out, so the point of this slide is to say you do get improvement. And that means that I think it's, and in fact, even in this case especially, the improvement is actually quite large, relative improvement. But then how do you capitalize on this? How do you take advantage, okay? And there, you know, which gates do you remove? And that's sort of the topic for the rest of the talk, and also constitutes the challenge that I mentioned earlier. Yeah.
So it's not what you would use a quantum computer for.
It's a thing you could use a quantum computer for. So this is something. This is what? Yeah. I mean, you could try to solve this problem, these kinds of problems, classically. And in the case of small instance sizes like this, then you definitely would not want to use a quantum computer. But part of the idea, one of the things people want to try using quantum computers for in the NISQ era is to solve classical problems like this. And it's absolutely not clear if this is a good idea, but it's something that people are trying.
In this picture, in the picture you showed now.
Oh, what happened?
Here, did you choose to make this improvement? Did you choose it randomly, or did you already use
it? No, this was not a random choice. So I'll say how we got these particular slides. This is just a preview of the result. Yeah, that'll be on a future slide. So the answer is you don't get anything good. So here is another kind of slide of results. So one thing is so this column here is just the regular QAOA using the energy as the expectation value of the energy. The sparse is what happens when you remove the right gates, okay? You get some kind of, it's hard to see, you know, this plot is sort of not normalized so well, so it's very hard to see that you get small, like 20, 30% improvements. Here, the improvements are much larger. Here, we see the effect of switching objective functions away from the expectation value of the energy to this Gibbs objective function. And here, you see that just doing that is an improvement. See that in both plots? And then doing both together gives you a large improvement. And this is what was this both together is what was displayed on the previous slide. Okay. So how do we do this? How do we do this search through architectures? You could choose randomly, but you could also try and choose more intelligently. As the graph gets very large, the search space through architectures is going to get very expensive to search through, so you don't search them one by one. You try and do something more intelligent. So what you can do is something called a beam search, where you look at all the possibilities for removing, say, one gate, score them according to some criterion, and this is, you know, how do you score them is part of the issue. Select some number of the best ones that perform from this level, and then remove another gate, select some number of the best performers, and then continue in this way, okay? So if the number that you select at the level, which is called the width of the search, was equal to 1, this would be like a greedy algorithm. If the number that you select was, unbounded, then this would be just a enumerative search. And then the question is, how do you do the scoring at the intermediate stages, okay? You could do a full simulation or run the quantum computer fully at each step, but that would be very expensive and not what you want to do. You could use some kind of heuristic to figure out how to score them at each step so that you end up with the best one at the end. and then pass that, only that one, to the quantum computer. You could use some kind of machine learning model to figure out what the highest ranked circuit architecture was. And this question, I think, is largely still open. So part of the ingredients in what you can do is you can try and do parameter estimation. So you remember some analytical formulas I had, at least for the square lattice case. Using those formulas and expanding, you know, making some approximations that maybe aren't fully justified, you can come up with a guess for what the optimal gamma parameter is. And it looks like this. And here's sort of some histogram of what it would be on different instances j, at least for the square lattice. And in this plot, okay, what this plot is it's what happens when you use as your scoring method at each level of the search, you fully simulate the quantum circuit, right? But in this case, in the first column, what you do is you optimize gamma by variational optimization. So you run the circuit enough times that you can figure out what the right gamma parameter is. In this column, you use this formula for gamma and don't bother trying to tune it. So this column involves fewer calls to the quantum computer. And in this column, you just use this sort of the median gamma for all instances, never mind what the couplings are. And that would give you these blue curves here, the orange curves, and the green curve. Now, the blue curve on these four plots here represents doing the search with the estimated or the fixed gamma. But then at the end, with the final circuit, you then numerically variationally optimize that circuit, okay, rather than using the estimated thing. And so you see, the thing that I want to highlight is, in particular, this middle plot here. So the orange represents what you get if you, all the way at the bottom of the search, you take that final circuit and you use the estimated or the fixed value of gamma, or sorry, in this column, just the estimated value of gamma for that final circuit, and don't try to optimize gamma, even for what you think is the best circuit. That gives you the orange line, which is, you know, at least in this case, gives you improved performance over the QAOA, which is dotted. In this case, the performance is actually not so good, and you'd be better off just using the original QAOA. However, if you take that last circuit, and rather than using gamma star, you variationally optimize gamma only on the final circuit, then you lift yourself up to this blue line, which seems to match what you would have gotten over here. So what this suggests is that using this gamma star gives you a good relative performance of the different quantum circuits, but not absolute performance. But then you can sort of fix up the absolute performance at the end. It works. That works almost as well also on the fixed gamma version. The horizontal axis here is the number of 2-qubit gates that you decide to remove. So, yeah. So this is in the top here is for the 4x4 grid of 16 qubits with 24 edges. And the bottom one here is the 10 qubit completely connected graph, so 45 edges. So all the way over here, we're removing 20 edges out of 24. So that's why the performance is just bad. And here, we're removing nearly half of the 2-qubit gates, and the performance is actually really good. I don't know why that is, but it's what we observe. Rather than simulating the quantum circuit at all with fixed parameters or not, you could try to use some heuristic, which is obviously the cheapest thing to do. So you can go back to that energy formula again. Even though we have no business really using this formula because we're not optimizing for the energy. But we can try it anyway. So you can figure out how much energy you gain by removing one of those 2-qubit gates and try to use that as a heuristic for which gates to remove. You could also use a machine learning guided search. Try to train some machine learning model. You run this many times in simulation, get some large data set, train some supervised learning model to figure out which gates it should remove given some choices of couplings, or train it to try to evaluate a scoring function something like that. And here's what you get from that. These results are just not good. So in this case, here's the simulation, the full simulation, using a greedy search where you only pick the best circuit at each level. And here, we're not going to use the quantum computer at all or any kind of simulation as we do our search. So the searching is actually very cheap, and we even give it a handicap. We allow it to keep the top 100 instances at every level, a large beam width. And then at the end, we choose the top n candidates, and n is plotted here. So we only had one candidate here, that's why the line is flat. And here, we had 100, but then we choose, you know, we look for the best out of the top, you know, n. So in this case, top 10. And you see that using all these heuristics or some kind of neural network, none of them really perform very well compared to the simulation. So we were, here's the random, removing random gates plot, which is mostly bad. So we can beat random, but we can't even accept a little bit here and there, even beat the original vanilla QALA. All right, so that's basically it. The question now, so there are a few sort of tidying up questions. What T's to cross and I's to dot, but I think it would be really interesting. I think there's a lot of potential for improvement here that is waiting to be actualized. Okay, I don't think this full simulation, you know, method of search is going to be, you know, at the end of the day, it's not what you would want to do in real life because the simulations are expensive. You know, you could try to see if a 3x improvement in the probability of a low energy state is somehow worth the time you took to do the search. You know, there's a calculation you can do, but it would be much better to be able to get that 3x improvement without doing the search that relies on using the quantum computer during the search. This is very analogous to trying to find analytically the variational parameters before you ever run the quantum computer. The same kind of thing, but the sort of discrete version. All right, so that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so whilst the next speaker gets set up, we can have time for one quick question. Sorry, raise your hand. Yeah, okay.
Sorry, maybe I'm mistaken. I'm just worried, most of your simulations, are they based on the fact that we are dealing with a perfect cubic? Because we know that there are no such things. If you integrate like the decoherence of the qubit in your computation, how will that affect the result?
Sorry, can you repeat the question? I didn't hear the question.
I'm wondering about the results that you have obtained. I'm guessing that they are based on the fact that you are dealing with the perfect qubit. And we know that there are no such things. But because
you're talking about the noise?
The most of the simulations that you showed are based on the fact that you are dealing with the perfect qubit. Because if you introduce like the decoherence of the qubit, how is that going to affect the result?
We didn't do a noisy simulation at all, but it's something that we could do, and maybe we will do before we finish, put in some kind of noise model. But as I mentioned, if you assume some kind of small like depolarizing noise on each gate, for example, which is I think a reasonable first approximation to what the Weyl error model might be. The effect on the result is something like, you know, you end up losing some amount of relative probability of success, and the amount of relative probability of success you lose, you can estimate, and it's a lot less. 30% or 200% gain that you make in our simulation.
So if you assume something like a 1% gate error on every gate, then the amount that you would lose due to noise is quite small. Basically, because we don't have that many gates.
Thank you.